The headlines: Lebanon's Hezbollah movement joins Palestinian resistance groups in hailing the shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to Israeli crimes. The U.S. approves another $100 million in military aid for Ukraine, and the EU backs a proposal to boost its funding of arms supplies to Kiev. And the Attorney General of the U.S. State of New York asks a judge to hold former President Donald Trump in contempt for violating a court order. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: at least two people are killed and nine more wounded in a Palestinian shooting operation in the Israeli capital, Tel Aviv. This was the fourth such attack in the last 2 weeks. Some of the victims are in critical condition. The shootings took place at several locations. Israeli forces later killed a Palestinian shooter in the city of Jaffa. Palestinian resistance groups have hailed the operation, with Hamas saying that it showed the ability of Palestinians to carry attacks in the heart of the occupied territories. A statement by Popular Resistance Committee says the attack was a legitimate response to intensified Israeli crimes. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has also hailed the operation. It says Palestinians once again demonstrated their ability to confront the occupying regime and respond to its crimes. "44 days into Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Let's take a look at the latest developments there. Kiev says over 30 people have been killed and more than 100 others wounded in a Russian rocket strike on Kramatorsk railway station in eastern Ukraine. According to Ukrainian officials, the railway is being used for civilian evacuations from the Donbass region. Meanwhile, mayor of the port city of Mariupol says at least 160,000 civilians remain stranded there. The mayor also says the civilian death toll stands at about 5,000. Elsewhere in the country, Russian forces have reportedly blockaded the northeastern city of Kharkiv. The United States has approved another $100 million in military aid for Ukraine. The U.S. has committed over 12,000 anti-armor systems, 1,400 anti-aircraft systems, and hundreds of kamikaze drones to Kiev. The move brings the total U.S. assistance to Ukraine to nearly $1.7 billion since the onset of Russia's operation in the country. That's why the U.S. and its NATO allies have claimed they are seeking to end the Ukraine crisis through diplomacy and dialogue. Well, Japan has joined the chorus of countries banning Russian diplomats over the military operation in Ukraine. The Japanese Foreign Ministry has expelled 8 Russian diplomats over, quote, war crimes, including the alleged killing of Ukrainian civilians by Russian troops. Russia's ambassador to Tokyo remains in the Japanese capital, while several trade officials will have to leave. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has also announced Japan's decision to impose new sanctions on Moscow, including a ban on Russian coal imports. This in the wake of growing anti-Russia sanctions by Tokyo's Western allies over the purported massacre of civilians by Russian soldiers around Kiev, particularly in the city of Bucha. Russia has denied the allegation and warned it will reciprocate the expulsion of its diplomats. Elsewhere, China says the U.S. is to blame for the, quote, crisis over Iran's nuclear program and must therefore promptly make the political decisions to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said Washington must actively respond to Iran's legitimate concerns. He said there's no better alternative to the JCPOA, and talks on its restoration have entered the final stage. Zhao said all parties have reached consensus on most of the final text, with a few items yet to be resolved. The JCPOA removed sanctions on Iran in exchange for limits on its nuclear program, but it was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally left in 2018. Iran and the other remaining parties to the deal, including China, have over the past year been holding talks in Vienna to restore the agreement, with the U.S. indirectly involved. The negotiations have stalled in the past. Yemen's Ansar al-Movement slams talks hosted by Saudi Arabia on the Yemeni conflict, saying the future of the country will be determined by Yemenis themselves. The spokesman for the movement says the Yemeni nation does not care about the talks. Sponsored by illegal parties, Mohammad Abdel Salam says the only option for the Saudi-led coalition to promote peace is to stop attacks, lift its siege, and move out its forces. Other than that, he says, efforts to settle the conflict are nothing but desperate attempts to regroup mercenaries and use them to escalate tensions. The remarks follow an announcement by former Yemeni President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi at the end of the Yemen talks in Riyadh that his authority and powers have been transferred to a new presidential council. Back in 2015, Hadi resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia. Afterwards, the kingdom launched a military campaign to bring him back to power, but to no avail. Political commentator Nasser Arabei says the talks hosted by Saudi Arabia will fail to result in any breakthrough in the Yemen conflict.
In fact, what happened in the Saudi capital is something that cares or that concerns those who are there, those who made the war and the aggression on Yemen. What matters most for the government in Sana'a is to end the war and also to lift the blockade, to end the suffering of the Yemeni people who have been suffering for about 7 years now. So the things that happened in Riyadh and the talks may concern the Saudis, the Emiratis, and their mercenaries, yes. But they do not matter those people who are or who have been have been under this blockade and sufferings for 7 years, as I said. There is no point at all, and there is no hope to for these talks to achieve anything as long as they take place there in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is an enemy. Saudi Arabia is behind all these things, all the suffering, all the bombings, and all the killings for 7 years.
Turkey was long spearheading efforts to bring those involved in the brutal assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to justice. Turkey has taken a U-turn on the case, surprising many who were hoping for some kind of punishment for the culprits.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish consul general's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government, and Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia.
The Turkish court's decision to halt legal proceedings against Saudi suspects has drawn strong condemnation from rights groups. Critics of the decision argue that the move could effectively end the case. Let's see what's believed to be behind Turkey's sudden U-turn on the case, on the murder case.
The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancé says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
The Attorney General of the U.S. State of New York asked a judge to hold former President Donald Trump in contempt for violating a court order. Attorney General Letitia James argues that Trump has failed to turn over documents related to the probe into possible fraud in Trump's business dealings. She has also asked the judge to fine Trump $10,000 a day until he turns over the material. Trump and two of his children were ordered in February to submit to questioning under oath, but the order is still under appeal. Trump was also ordered to present a series of accounting and tax documents relevant to his organization. The attorney who has been pursuing the probe since 2019 says Donald Trump has been trying to evade the court order. And now to Peru, where the government has declared a state of emergency on all its highways in a bid to clear roadblocks set up by truckers protesting against price hikes. The measure allows for the army to be deployed, clearing the blockades, while also suspending certain constitutional rights such as freedom of movement. Anger prevails across the South American nation over rising fuel and fertilizer prices. President Pedro Castillo has taken various measures to end the protests, including cutting taxes on fuel and raising the minimum wage. This week, he also declared a curfew in Lima to try to stifle dissent, but thousands defied the order and took to the streets in protests that later turned violent. The situation has put Castillo's political future in danger. His approval rating has dipped to a record low of 19%. He recently survived a second impeachment in less than a year in power. And in other news, secret letters from Prince Charles to notorious pedophile Jimmy Savile have resurfaced. The heir to the British throne had sought the advice of the now-disgraced ex-DJ to use his expertise to help the royal family handle its speechwriting, charity, and PR issues. A correspondence spanning two decades has been seen as yet another issue that will stoke anti-monarchy sentiment for the royals already struggling with declining support. Amina Taylor has more.
One of these men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Savile for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Savile seems surprising. These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without at a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps. The association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Many Yemenis feel that the war on their country has been forgotten despite its significantly higher death toll and the fact that it is marked by much more blatant violations of human rights. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading "On its 7th anniversary, Yemen seeks to end a war the world has forgotten." This is the first part of the article. Seven years have passed since the brutal war against Yemen, a ship-shaped country located on the southern Arabian Peninsula, began in March 2015. The war has been acknowledged as one of the bloodiest in modern history and called the world's worst humanitarian disaster by human rights groups. Yet, rather than breaking Yemeni resolve, the Saudi-led war backed by collective military might of the world's most powerful nations has only strengthened the poorest country in the West Asia region. And Ansarullah is now stronger and more united than it has ever been. On the 7th anniversary of the war, Mint Press News spoke with survivors, relatives of victims, and refugees of the conflict, who recount their stories and explore the current state of the conflict, as evidence suggests that the Saudi-led coalition's grip on Yemen may be loosening. I remember when a huge explosion rocked my home, then I went up on the roof. There were fires like a volcano, Murad Yahya told Mint Press, referring to Saudi airstrikes that killed an entire family in Bani Hawat shortly after Saudi Arabia announced Operation Decisive Storm. Yahya, a father in his 60s who was displaced from his home, now lives in a makeshift refugee camp in Dahan Center for Displaced in northern Sana'a. Despite the short supply and high prices of goods, Yahya says he has become more determined to persevere. Today I see the same fires not here but in Saudi Arabia, he said, referring to the images of huge fires that were plastered across international media last week after Ansarullah struck a Saudi state-run oil facility in Jeddah. The attack, which came amid international concerns about the future of energy, was intended to send a message to Riyadh and its allies alike, particularly to the Biden administration, that Yemenis are not only still steadfast and stronger than before, but are resolved to break the stifling blockade on their country that has been imposed by the Saudi-led U.S.-backed coalition since 2015. It is part of a renewed effort by Ansarullah's Air Force to impose a costly penalty on the Persian Gulf nations and their backers for their war on Yemen, which has sparked massive fuel shortages, water shortages, and famine on a near-biblical scale in the world's poorest nation. Dubbed Operation Breaking the Siege Third, the largest-scale offensive against high-value facilities inside of Saudi Arabia will likely bear the hallmark of Ansarullah. Ballistic and winged missiles and drone attacks against the sensitive targets across the Saudi kingdom. Attacks have already struck targets in the Saudi capital Riyadh and the southern cities of Dhahran al-Janub, Abha, and Khamis Mosheid were pounded by dozens of missiles and drones. Energy facilities in the strategic regions of Jizan and Najran and in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah were also struck, along with the oil refineries in Ras Tanura and Rabigh, and a power station in Samta, according to Ansarullah officials. The offensive represents the fiercest operation by Ansarullah against Saudi Arabia to date. It dwarfs the September 2019 attacks against Saudi Arabia's oil facilities in Abqir and Khurais, which led to a suspension of about 50% of the Arab kingdom's crude and gas production. It took over 50 firefighting teams more than 24 hours to extinguish the massive blaze from the recent attack on the Saudi oil facilities in Jeddah. Even then, massive plumes of smoke covered the coastal city, causing an unprecedented state of panic. Saudi state-owned media broadcasted every aspect of the attack live in an attempt to either gain international sympathy or alarm the international community. In the wake of the attacks, crude oil prices surged and broke $120 per barrel. While attacks on Saudi state-run oil refineries or gas plants affect the financial returns of the kingdom's royal family, Ansarullah hopes that targeting critical infrastructure like the desalination plant, the main source of water for more than 25 million Saudis, will bring the war to every home in the kingdom and pose a real threat to the legitimacy of the Saudi kingdom, forcing it to end the war and lift the siege.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Life of a Muslim Changes in the Holy Month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. We know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, eat and drink until the white thread, that is, the dawn twilight, becomes visible from the black thread, that is, darkness below the horizon, and then complete the fast till nighttime. In chapter number 2, verse number 187. So during the month, the blessed month, the holy month of Ramadan, the daily schedule of a Muslim and a Muslim family changes. So it's not just at an individual level. It's from the breadwinner of the house to, you know, the kids and the wives and the, you know, other relatives, you know, the elderly people. Everybody's life changes every year in this holy month of Ramadan. They get up while it is still nighttime to have their pre-dawn meal, the suhoor, and then go without food, drink, or smoking for the entire day until the night. That is when they break their fast. The Quran is very clear that the fasting starts from dawn and ends after the night has set in. Then complete the fast till night, is as it is said in the verse. And that is why the Shia Muslims, in following the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, emphasize that one has to wait for some time after the sunset to break the fast, because in their view, sunset, al-ghurub, and night, al-layl, are not the same. This is a discussion for another day, but we just wanted to give you a hint to all our audiences and all our listeners who may be listening to this, that we have to be very careful in times of opening up and breaking our fast. Our lives change in this blessed month. Now the question is, how far do they change? Is it just in terms of our schedules, or is it more than that? We hope, wish, and pray that it is more than that. Our lives, they should change in every aspect, especially the spiritual aspect. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing about a life of a Muslim in the blessed month of Ramadan. We said not only the individual life changes for a Muslim, but his entire family's life changes. Now, if you live in an Islamic country, you would know that the environment changes with it too. If you are good practicing mu'min Muslim, you know that your personal etiquettes to your actions, to your recitation of Quran, to du'as, to attending the mosque. All of this becomes different in this blessed month. Now, ideally, we should maintain the state throughout the year, but we know, unfortunately, most of us, we're not able to. Yet, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us an opportunity every year to make sure that we are back on track, back on the schedule of a believer. The life becomes like a life of a believer. So it's an opportunity. Don't take it as a burden. And we know, you know, given the world we live in, it's not easy to do sometimes. But trust me, if you start looking at it as an opportunity to gain proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this new schedule will start looking easier to you. Right? The length of the days of Ramadan depends on the season in which that month occurs. The Islamic calendar is based on the lunar system. It is 10 days shorter than the common calendar. An Islamic month begins with the sighting of the new moon and ends upon the sighting of the next new moon. When Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, occurs in winter, the days are shorter and it is easier to fast. But when Ramadan occurs in summer, the days are longer, and it is not that easy to fast, right? This is one example of the justice and fairness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to some of our scholars, so that all people may fast through various seasons. And that is why the lunar system of calendar is preferable for the religious practices and rituals. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have, in many cases, risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world, says Stephen Zeun's journalist in an article titled "Democrats Attack Amnesty Report on Israeli Regime to Justify U.S. Complicity in Human Rights Abuses." Please stay tuned. The Biden administration and congressional leaders of both parties have launched a full frontal assault on the integrity of Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization. This decidedly mainstream non-governmental organization, NGO, which is a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, boasts more than 10 million members worldwide and is cited frequently by the U.S. government agencies, was embraced by most leading Democrats until it released its latest report last week regarding systematic violations of international humanitarian law by the Zionist regime, a very close U.S. ally. The 280-page report systematically examined the Zionist regime's fragmentation of the Palestinian population into zones of control, dispossession of land and property, segregation, restrictions on economic and social rights, home demolitions and forced evictions, family separations and other human rights violations. It made a very strong case that such practices collectively constitute the legal definition of apartheid, that is, serious human rights violations perpetrated in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another, with the intention to maintain that system. Despite the compelling nature of Amnesty's investigation, U.S. Ambassador to the Occupied Territories, Tom Knives, immediately called the well-researched report absurd. And U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price roundly rejected the report's conclusion as well, adding, "The Jewish people must not be denied the right to self-determination, even though there was nothing in the report questioning that." Price prevaricated when asked by a reporter why the State Department was so quick to denounce Amnesty in this case, while being quite willing to cite Amnesty authoritatively when it criticized governments opposed by Washington. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer falsely claimed that Amnesty's detailed report on the Zionist regime's violations of international humanitarian law constituted delegitimizing the existence of Israel, despite absolutely nothing in the report questioning the Zionist regime's legitimacy in any way. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Robert Menendez, without offering specifics, accused Amnesty of slander and misinformation, baselessly claiming that the organization was denying Israel's right to exist. The Senate Democrats' de facto foreign policy spokesman insisted that the Zionist regime actually values human rights, despite findings to the contrary in countless well-documented reports from Amnesty and other human rights groups. Representative Gregory Meeks, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, claimed that implementing Amnesty International's recommendations to challenge the Zionist regime's apartheid policies in the West Bank would threaten Israel's existence. The Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer made clear that the Democratic caucus remained solidly in support of the Zionist regime against human rights groups, insisting that amnesty was fueling hatred against Jews, and pledging that the Democratic House Majority will continue to stand with Israel and Jewish communities in effort to end the spread of misinformation and the vilification of Israel and Jews. Other congressional Democrats jumped on the attack. A joint statement by Representatives Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Brad Schneider, Lois Frankel, Ilan Luria, Kathy Manning, Josh Gottemeyer, Dean Phillips, Brad Sherman, and Jake Achiklas explicitly denied well-documented Zionist regime human rights abuses and insisted that the Zionist regime was actually a vibrant democracy where all citizens, regardless of religion or race, have rights. These prominent Democratic lawmakers falsely claim that the report is steeped in anti-Semitism and claim that Amnesty's willingness to criticize well-documented violations of international humanitarian law was part of Amnesty's broad, decades-long campaign to criminalize and delegitimize the world's only Jewish states. Indeed, in recent years, as the discrimination against Palestinians in areas controlled by the Zionist regime has become increasingly severe and institutionalized under a series of U.S.-backed right-wing governments, multiple other human rights groups, including Human Rights Watch and the Israeli group B'Tselem, have also started using the term apartheid in regard to the Zionist regime's policies, as have world leaders including former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, and former US Secretary of War James Mattis, among others. A second charge by Biden officials and congressional leaders was that Amnesty International was unfairly singling out the Zionist regime for its criticism. In reality, over the past dozen years, Amnesty International has published over 2,000 reports, and only 35 have been about the Zionist regime. Nothing in the report was anti-Semitic. Indeed, over a dozen prominent Israeli NGOs have penned a letter defending Amnesty from these spurious charges, noting how the struggle against anti-Semitism in the world is being weakened by the unbearable, inaccurate, and instrumentalized use to which the anti-Semitism accusation is lodged for political ends in order to avoid debate about the Zionist regime's oppressive policies toward the Palestinians. Given these brazen misrepresentations, it is doubtful that the Congress members or Biden administration officials who are criticizing the Amnesty report have actually read it fully. What mattered was that it challenged a basic premise of U.S. West Asia region policy that the Zionist regime is, as described in the 2016 Democratic platform, as they claim baselessly, a beacon of democracy, equality, tolerance, and pluralism. This assertion has for decades been used to justify tens of billions of taxpayer dollars to arm dead regimes, right-wing cabinets, block the United Nations Security Council from taking action to resolve the conflict, defend the Zionist regime's war crimes, and advance the notion that it is the Palestinians under occupation, not the Israeli regime's occupiers, who are responsible for the failure to reach a negotiated peace settlement. What may have also provoked such a fiery reaction is the section of the report which appears to be referring to the United States. It reads, "Apartheid has no place in our world, and states which choose to make allowances for Israel will find themselves on the wrong side of history. Governments who continue to supply Israel with arms and shield it from accountability at the UN are supporting a system of apartheid, undermining the international legal order, and exacerbating the suffering of the Palestinian people," unquote. It is this recognition that the United States has a moral and legal responsibility to end its support for violations of international humanitarian law committed by strategic allies that has led so many leading Democrats to side with the Republican right in its attacks on Amnesty International. This intensified in subsequent decades when the organization reported human rights abuses by U.S.-backed Latin American dictatorships and paramilitaries, exposed the massacres by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in East Timor, criticized torture by U.S. interrogators in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and documented the large civilian death toll in airstrikes by U.S.-armed Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip and U.S.-armed Saudi forces in Yemen. This time, as an indication of the rightward drift of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration and congressional Democratic leaders have agreed with the Republicans that research documenting violations of international humanitarian law by U.S. allies can no longer be tolerated. They have decided to take the political risks of attacking the world's leading human rights organization and lie about the contents of its reports to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Why would so many prominent Democrats risk alienating so many people in their base, including millions of liberals who have long supported Amnesty and other human rights groups, by making demonstrably false charges against this beloved and well-respected NGO? Perhaps they assume that relatively few people will actually read the report, and that enough of the public will believe their false claims about it to undermine Amnesty's reputation for fairness. Amnesty's reputation for critiquing human rights abuses across the board has been one of its greatest strengths. The organization has been critical of human rights abuses regardless of the violator's ideology, geopolitical alignment, ethnicity, religion, or anything else. The organization's reports have fueled movements to end U.S. culpability in war crimes, which threaten the profits of politically influential arms exporters. Perhaps the Biden administration and its supporters are making these false accusations that Amnesty International actually seeks to delegitimize or unfairly single out Israel in the hopes that it will damage Amnesty's reputation enough that reports about violations of international humanitarian law by other U.S. allies will not be taken seriously either. If the Biden administration and Democratic congressional leaders can get away with attacking Amnesty International for its criticisms of the Zionist regime's violations of international law, they could also start attacking Amnesty for its criticisms of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and other U.S. allies. Given the preeminence of Amnesty International in the global human rights movement, this is nothing less than a frontal attack on the human rights community as a whole. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world. Even when democratic leaders initially rejected calls for sanctions on white minority-ruled South Africa, they opposed military aid to the regime and were outspoken in their opposition to apartheid. By contrast, today, they support unconditional military aid to the Zionist regime, deny that the system imposed by that right-wing cabinet on the occupied West Bank is a form of apartheid, and attack reputable human rights groups that present evidence otherwise. The Democrats figure that, with so many people scared of a Republican takeover of the House and Senate in November, human rights supporters will be reluctant to challenge their war on Amnesty and other groups. This may end up hurting the Democratic Party, however. With Biden administration officials, both the House and Senate majority leaders, heads of both the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees, and scores of other congressional Democrats joining Fox News and the Republicans in attacking, misrepresenting, and outright lying in an effort to discredit and marginalize one of the world's foremost human rights organizations, people may start wondering whether they can support both human rights and Democratic Party.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble tradition which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this is about an evil trait that, God forbid, any of us should have, and that is showing off. Showing off is one of those evil traits that kind of ruins our good deeds, right? It has been reprimanded and scorned in the hadith and in the verses of the Holy Quran. For example, in the Holy Quran, we read the following: "Do not be like those who left their homes vainly and to show off to the people and to bar other people from the way of Allah, and Allah comprehends what they do." In this beautiful hadith, Imam Sadiq talks about the deeds of a person who shows off, and also the deeds of a person who performs his deeds in secret. In this month of, we're in the month of Ramadan, and you know, our actions are being recorded, and you know, the good actions we perform, we're getting rewards for them, even more rewards than that than the rewards that we would get if we performed them in other months, right? So we should be careful not to perform these good deeds in order to show off to people, or because we want to become popular, we want to be known as a pious person in their eyes, right? Let's all perform our good deeds in this month for the sake of Allah. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "The deed of one who performs it in secret is recorded down as a secret action. If he admits to having performed it when asked, the previous record is erased and it is recorded instead as a public action." So let's say that we're in the month of Ramadan. Let's say that you woke up in the morning and you decided to read some Quran. So you're reading Quran, you're getting a lot of sawab for it. Nobody knows that you're reading the Quran, so you're doing it in your room all alone. So when you do this in secret, Allah records this act amongst the secret acts that nobody knows. Obviously, you get more reward for it. But let's say that later on, you go to school or you go to work and your boss or your teacher says, "Oh, you look tired today. What happened?" And you kind of slip up and say, "Oh, it's because I woke up in the morning and I was reading a lot of Quran." Now that you've told the person about somebody else about it, it's now the previous record is erased and the act is considered a public act. So kind of the reward has been decreased. In continuation, the Imam alayhi salam says, "If he subsequently avers it himself, however, the previous record is erased and it is recorded instead as showing off." Right? It is recorded as an act of showing off. So this is a very dangerous thing that we should take into consideration and be careful about. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at showing off in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.